The Defense Department is looking at many possibilities for budget savings, but their choices are becoming more limited as Congress tells the Pentagon what it can't cut. That leaves the department with fewer and fewer choices, and those choices get worse and worse. Todd Harrison is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He and his colleague Mark Gunzinger, writing in the Wall Street Journal under the headline "Congress Handcuffs Pentagon Cost Cutters," and Todd is my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. Todd, it's always great to have you on the program. Congratulations on this piece. As you and Mark write, the Murray-Ryan budget deal hit a 2 out of 3. There are 3 simple rules that you're proposing. They got 2 of them right. Outline those rules and then tell me which one they left out.
Sure. Well, you know, what many of us have been saying for a while in the defense community is if you're going to cut the budget, then 3 rules. So first, you need to gradually decline in the budget over time, not take a sharp drop. And you need some level of budgetary certainty out into the future. It'll never be totally certain, but some greater level of certainty. And then you need, third thing is you need to give DOD flexibility to make smart, strategically informed reductions. And so the Ryan Murray compromise plan, it does the first two. It gives DOD a more gradual decline in funding over the next 2 years. That's better than the sharp drop that we were facing this year. And it also gives some level of certainty because at least we've got a 2-year agreement now, and that's better than having no agreement halfway through the fiscal year. So they've done pretty well on the first two. But the thing Congress still needs to do is give DOD flexibility. And here we're not just talking about, oh, we'll pass an appropriations every year. It's more than that they need to give DOD.
The subhead to your piece is bases that can't be closed, weapons that can't be retired, benefits that can't be touched. What's left? Question mark. The essentials. And it gets really to the heart of a conversation that it seems to me, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong, has been happening kind of in back channels and at lunches and dinners across Washington for many months, maybe years. But nobody's really willing, until I believe you and Mark, to kind of slap Congress across the face and say, wait a minute, a lot of the issues that are going on here start with you.
Yeah, well, you know, it wasn't intended as a slap in the face.
No, I understand that.
Maybe a toss of cold water in the face.
Okay. All right. That's a better analogy. I'll take that.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, we need to wake up and realize that if you put so many different restrictions on DOD that they're over-constrained, they have no freedom of movement to navigate this downturn. And Congress has said, no, you can't close bases. They've rejected DOD's repeated calls to give them the ability to close bases here in the United States. DOD is operating at about 20% excess capacity in basing structure. 85% of that is in the United States. No private company would tolerate that kind of waste, yet Congress seems to want that kind of waste built into the defense budget every year. So that's the first thing, is Congress has got to give them that flexibility to close things they don't need anymore. The second thing is DOD has proposed year after year different changes to the military compensation system, and Congress has repeatedly rejected most, if not all, of those changes proposed by DOD. Well, you know, something's got to give. If they don't get the personnel cost under control, they're going to gradually eat up more and more of the budget, or DOD will be forced to cut the size of the force, to cut people so that those costs don't crowd out other parts of the budget. Either way, it's not sustainable in the long run.
A couple of observations on each of those points, Todd. The BRAC issue is fascinating to me because I had Catherine Hammock from the Army on the program not long ago talking about the fact that they're essentially doing their own BRAC overseas where they don't need congressional approval to do it and saving tremendous amounts of money. And so it's not a case where Congress can say, well, you don't really want to do this. You're just saying this, try to box the military into the corner. They're doing it the places that they can actually do it.
Right. The restriction applies here in the U.S. I believe it's any facility that employs more than like 300 people. is what they're not allowed to close without specific authorization from Congress. So, yeah, they're already doing it overseas. And a lot of people who oppose the BRAC, they say, oh, well, you should cut bases overseas first. Done. They're already doing that. But they need to cut them here in the United States as well. And, you know, with compensation reform, we saw this tiny change. And, you know, we can debate whether or not this was a fair thing to do. But this tiny change in the military retirement cost of living adjustment, a minus 1% growth, 1% less than inflation in future years, it would save $6 billion over the next 10 years out of a projected $4 trillion we will be spending on total military compensation-related costs in the federal budget. They save $6 billion. Tiny change, and look at the uproar we've gotten from it. But, you know, if you can't do the, if you can't control number of facilities, if you can't control your personnel cost, and our third component that we talked about was being able to retire legacy weapon systems, Congress is putting handcuffs on DOD there as well. If you can't retire your old weapon systems, what are you left with? What can you do?
We are supposed to be about 4 months out from results from the Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission. However, that's now pushed to 2015, and one of the members of that commission said, well, the benefit to that is it pushes it after the 2014 elections. Yeah. And I see the logic of that given what you've just talked about, and I think everybody's familiar with the military version of the third rail when it comes to Congress and compensation. But you've studied the compensation issue pretty extensively, including we've talked about the survey that you conducted not too long ago. Do you get a sense that the Compensation Commission is asking the right questions and is looking the right places to be able to present information to the SecDef that really will make a difference? And what do they do to make sure that that information doesn't go to Congress, fall on deaf ears, and wind up on a shelf somewhere?
Well, I think it's a positive development that the commission's life was extended, you know, not just because of the politics of it. Now they'll report after the midterm elections, and maybe Congress will actually look at what they proposed and be willing to act on it. But also it's going to give the commission more time to go out and collect the data they need and do the analysis they need to do to come back to Congress and say, hey, you know, here is a sensible set of reforms, and maybe we're going to cut in some areas, maybe we'll make improvements in other areas, but the net effect is we're going to reduce compensation costs, and we're going to do it in a way that is sensitive to what the troops actually value, what their preferences are in terms of different compensation, so we can minimize the negative effect on the force. You know, hopefully this extra time will you know, be used wisely by the commission to go out and do that hard work and perhaps conduct a survey like we had done at CSBA. It's been about a year and a half since we did that survey. If they could go out and do something like that on a larger scale with a randomized sample, then they would have a powerful set of analysis to bring back to Congress.
Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, he and his colleague Mark Gunzinger writing about the situation the Pentagon's in budget-wise in the Wall Street Journal, and you can find a link to that later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Take me back to that compensation survey for a minute, Todd. Are there misconceptions that exist either in the general public that thinks about defense issues or in Congress in particular about the way the people that actually receive military compensation perceive what they get?
You know, I think the biggest misperception out there is people conflate the terms veterans and retirees, and they often talk about, oh, we're cutting veterans benefits, when really they're talking about cutting retiree benefits, and they don't recognize the distinction between the two. So military retirees obviously are veterans. They are a subset of veterans. In fact, a pretty small subset. Only about 17% of people who serve in the military actually stay long enough to earn a retirement. You know, the other 83% leave before they reach retirement age, you know, after 20 years of service. They are veterans, that other 83%, but they're not retirees. And so when we talk about military compensation, I think members of Congress and the general public get confused. Like this reduction in the military retirement COLA, that only applies to military retirees. That's not a veteran's benefit. you know, the vast majority of people who serve in the military don't get this retirement pay because they didn't stay 20 years to earn a retirement. And so people, you know, in their mind, they conjure up images of veterans, young troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, having served bravely, fought for our country, and they think that this is going to affect them, and this is actually going to affect very few, if any, of them.
An issue that you write about along with Mark is something that we've talked about on this show before and that I've talked about with a number of other people, and that's the weapons systems issue. And that's where I want to go next when we come back. Todd Harrison's my guest from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments on Pentagon Solutions today on In Depth with Francis Rose. We'll be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guest on Pentagon Solutions today is Todd Harrison, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He and his colleague, Mark Gunzinger, writing under the headline Congress Handcuffs Pentagon Cost Cutters in the Wall Street Journal. And a link up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Todd, you and Mark get at the idea of weapon systems here and the concept that the Pentagon is trying to make hard choices in that area as well and not getting any cooperation from Congress. But I see two issues here. There's the issue that you and Mark address head on, which is systems that the Pentagon doesn't want that Congress makes them buy. There's also the issue of systems that they want, like the F-35 and LCS and others, that they aren't buying very well. And those, there are areas, I think, in both of those that are ripe for at least examination about how you control costs and keep the end prices down. Is that fair to say?
No, that's absolutely fair to say. The difference, though, between those two is, in one case, it's just a matter of Congress acting out of parochial political interest, that they won't let the Navy retire ships or they won't let the Air Force retire certain aircraft. And really the reason there is nothing to do with strategy. It's just a matter of they want to preserve jobs in their districts, quite frankly. On the other side of the acquisition side, yeah, DOD doesn't do a great job acquiring a lot of the new weapon systems that are supposed to replace some of these things they want to retire. But I think DOD and Congress are in agreement there that they need to do better in acquisition. I don't think it's a matter of DOD not wanting to do it or Congress not wanting to, you know, let them be better at acquiring systems. I think it's just a matter of figuring out how, in such a large bureaucracy, do you develop a way where you can acquire systems efficiently with appropriate oversight, but without excessive oversight that ends up sinking the program. So I think that is kind of the distinction there. Everyone wants acquisition reform. It's just a matter of how. But with these legacy weapon systems, you know, the Air Force, you know, it's reported now that they're going to ask to retire the entire fleet of A-10s. Those are ground attack aircraft used for close air support, primarily for ground troops. You know, I don't think anyone can question what a great aircraft the A-10 has been. Performed spectacularly in the first Gulf War, performed spectacularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's been a great platform. But you know what? In a budget-constrained environment, you have to make hard choices. Something's got to go. The Air Force and the Army have other systems that can perform the same mission of close air support. We can argue whether they perform them as well or as efficiently, but we've got other systems that can do the job. And so something's got to go, and the Air Force says, hey, we'd like to make a vertical cut here and eliminate the entire fleet. We can save a lot of money doing it.
You write, some members of Congress are already working to prevent the Air Force from making financially smart and strategically informed reductions. It's very diplomatic of you not to mention Senator Ayotte in that passage, Todd. But this is not peculiar to the Air Force, and you mentioned the situation in the Navy as well. Are we fair to say that it's only parochial, or are there potentially strategic reasons that some members of Congress have for these issues?
I mean, when they make their arguments, sometimes they will actually try to, you know, say, oh, we actually need the capability for such and such reason. But it's pretty easy to poke through a lot of those arguments, and especially – the military experts, the people who actually go out and fight the wars, when they're saying they don't need something, and this is a pretty risk-averse crowd, the military, you know, it's very easy for them to say they do need something. When they actually come out and say they don't need something, then you probably ought to listen, that maybe there's not a good strategic justification for it anymore.
An acquisition issue, Todd, that you didn't address in this piece, but I wonder if you have some thoughts about it. And that is, are we looking at the idea of acquisition too romantically, that, wow, it's really terrible today, but back in the good old days, we seemed to get it right? Or could we go back and look at, and I'm not picking on the A-10 or the KC-10, they just happen to be in front of me because you referenced them in this piece. Could we go back to weapon systems historically and discover, if we really read hard, that they had similar problems because this is something that the Pentagon hasn't done well since it was the Pentagon?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. My colleague Barry Watts and I did a paper a couple of years ago where we actually went back and looked at cost overruns and major acquisition programs. And if you go back to like the 1950s and 1960s, it actually looks very similar to today. You see major cost overruns on some of the major programs of the time. And, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, the difficulty involved with buying new technologically complex equipment, in many cases, things that have never been built before. The reason you see a lot of cost overruns is because it's hard to estimate the cost of something that's never been built. And that's not, it's not unique to DOD. It's certainly not new to DOD. But, you know, that's not a reason to give up. That's a reason that we need to try harder and harder to get better at estimating costs, to get better at managing these acquisition programs, and do a better job of constraining requirements and requirements creep, and letting industry do its job of innovating.
You write, along with your colleague Todd Gunzinger, to close this piece out in Wall Street Journal, Todd, with all of these constraints layered on top of one another, not being able to close bases, reform compensation, retire legacy weapons, the Pentagon has few degrees of freedom left. It's time for Congress to set aside politics and give the Defense Department the flexibility to do what's best for the nation, both fiscally and strategically. Is it your sense that DOD is doing everything that it can to demonstrate to Congress that it's prepared to do what it needs to do, if only Congress would let it do so, or is there still work to do on the Pentagon side, too?
To tell. I think that DOD is going to do just that in the next budget request, but we'll wait and see when that comes out. But I think that they are likely to submit a budget that says, look, we're willing to make the hard choices. Come with us. Join us, Congress. This is not going to be easy. Let's do it together. Let's grab hands and let's jump over the cliff together. But, you know, there are a lot of hard choices that need to be made. In last year's budget and the budget before, DOD was not willing to do that. They weren't willing to show what those hard choices were. They weren't willing to show their hand on what decisions they would make. But I think everything I'm hearing is this time around is going to be different. DOD is actually going to lay all their cards on the table and say, look, here it is. Here's what we've got to do.
Do you think a lack of auditability and a lack of ability to hit a deadline for auditability is impeding the Pentagon's ability to go to Congress and say, here's exactly why we can justify you giving us what we want?
I think it's actually that's a side issue. I mean, the DOD does need to be audited. They need to be able to pass an audit and get their books in order. But I don't think it's directly related to the problem we're talking here. It is indirectly related because I think members of Congress look at the fact that DOD has not been able to pass an audit or even meet its own deadlines for, you know, being able to pass an audit, and they say, look, you don't have control of your finances. Why should we trust you? Why should we give you more money? You know, so I think indirectly it's having that effect. But directly, if DOD were to pass an audit today, I highly doubt that audit would turn up $50 billion a year in money that DOD somehow had tucked away and could spend on something else. It's audits don't find that kind of money. If they did, if there was that kind of money sitting around unused, you would know it. You would need an audit to tell you. But, you know, I don't think we should put too much faith in how much money an audit will save. I think it's more a matter of accountability.
Todd, congratulations to you and Mark on this, and thank you for being on to talk about it with me. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's good to be back.